Hi, this is spoken word artist Tribal Rain.
And this is Max Parthas, host of New Abolitionist Radio, modern day slavery abolitionists. And you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. On today's broadcast, host Latara Smith spends the hour with Jonathan Irons, a prisoner in the Missouri Corrections System, about the hurdles and dead ends built into the appeals process, his fight to prove his innocence, and the work necessary to overturn a conviction. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Latara and her guest.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to us this morning here on the Jaws of Justice radio show on KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project, your host for the show today. And today I have the privilege of interviewing a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Irons. Actually, Mr. Irons is here with us live on the line now. Mr. Irons, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, and I'm just going to tell everybody a little bit about who you are and your situation. Mr. Irons is another innocent, wrongly convicted Missourian who has been in prison since the age of 16 years old for a crime that he did not commit. And today we are going to be talking about the issues of what leads to these wrongful convictions, and, you know, one of the main issues is there's problems with eyewitness identification, and then also there's a big issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. So we'll go into what exactly those are, what those terms mean here in just a second. But Mr. Irons, can you just tell us a little bit about your situation and the type of charge that you're fighting right now? What actually led to your wrongful incarceration?
Well, I believe overall I just didn't have a fair trial. My attorney didn't do what she was supposed to do. She was ineffective, and the prosecutor basically just trampled all over my rights.
Okay. Now, real quick, tell our viewers exactly what you're in there for, what you were charged with, and the amount of time that was given to you for this crime that you did not commit.
Oh, I was convicted of first-degree assault, armed criminal action, and first-degree burglary, and I received 50 years, which people of murder have received less time than I got.
50 years, at the age of 16, correct?
Yes.
So you've been incarcerated a total of how many years to date?
20. I'm 37 now.
37. So you've been in 20 years for a crime that you didn't commit. Now,
yes, ma'am.
You had mentioned that, you know, basically your conviction came about because of things that your attorney did not do. Is that correct?
Yeah, that and as well as the prosecutor.
Okay. And then there was also some issues, according to what I've read on your case, there was also some eyewitness identification issues,
yes,
being
ma'am.
That, you know, at one point your eyewitness said one thing, and then, you know, in his narrative and his police narrative, and then, of course, something totally different during the trial, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Okay. Well, now, I want to go back and let our viewers know what we mean by assistance of counsel, because many people don't know what is the assistance of counsel. And so the Supreme Court held that a part of the right to counsel is a right to effective assistance of counsel, okay? And then you have the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, which is a claim raised by someone like yourself, a convicted criminal defendant. And basically, you know, you're saying that this attorney did not do, you know, all that he could have done, he or she could have done, to sufficiently represent you in your case. So then that becomes what you call ineffective assistance of counsel. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's like somebody's driving a car, two people riding it, and the driver takes their hands off the steering wheel.
Right. That's a good example. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that. And then here in Missouri, when you go past, let's see, what is it, the 2915, that is when most claims of ineffective assistance of counsel comes up, correct?
Yes, either that or 24.035.
Okay, so those are the times when the issues of ineffective assistance of counsel, someone's attorney not doing what they should have done, whether that be interviewing witnesses, finding witnesses, just different things. In your case, what actually happened where you're saying that your attorney was ineffective?
Well, the main issue in my case, which the prosecutor acknowledged, is that I wouldn't have been bound over for trial had the eyewitness identified me at the preliminary hearing. So the identification is the central issue of my case. My public defender at the time, she had filed a motion to suppress the identification evidence, and then later, without even telling me, she withdrew the motion. And then when I asked her about it, she says, well, you can always file an ineffective assistance of counsel claim about it.
Right. So basically, we're not going to address it now. We're going to bump it off till later.
Yeah, exactly. No, just period. We're not even going to talk about it. Her strategy was, well, I don't think you were identified, so it makes a better argument for the jury to hear that. But in actuality, she didn't argue it that way. You know, it's been scientifically proven that when juries hear or see an eyewitness and say, hey, man, this is the guy who did this crime against me, they're more than likely going to believe it, and they're going to disregard anything else because the witnesses appear to be confident in what they're saying. They're coached and they're trained by the prosecutor and the police department.
Right, right. And I have seen that in several cases. Most definitely I have seen that in several cases, especially in the case of Keith Carnes. Most definitely have seen that go on. But I want to go back to this because I know we gave the definition of what assistance of counsel and ineffective assistance of counsel is. But now I want to go over and let our viewers know exactly what eyewitness identification means, okay? Because some people really don't know these things. Eyewitness identification is when a witness identifies the perpetrator of a crime, okay, based upon their identification or actual physical perception of the crime. There's a lot of problems with eyewitness testimony, a lot. And actually, I was reading some stats last night, and I was floored to know this because I didn't know this percentage was that high. But it says, since the 1990s, when DNA testing was first introduced, the Innocence Project researchers have reported that 73% of the 239 convictions overturned through DNA testing were based on eyewitness testimony. That is crazy. That's a very high percent, a very high percent. And so it makes you have to look at this issue with eyewitness identification. I know over on the Kansas side, they've done some things, that they've got some things recently approved that has to do with the, I don't know the specifics, but I do know over on the Kansas side, they've you know, done some things concerning the eyewitness identification, which, you know, I have to applaud them for. I believe Mr. Sykes may have had something to do with that, and Senator Bailey, I believe. But it all kind of works hand in hand with the ineffective assistance of counsel, the eyewitness. We see this over and over again when it comes to wrongful convictions. So now, Mr. Irons, tell us a little bit more about your wrongful conviction, what it is that you most definitely was able to see now that you couldn't see in the beginning, you know, as you began to, because I believe you've had an advocacy team now that is really supporting you and that is really helping you. And one of the individuals of that advocacy team really, really took up your case and investigated and found a lot of things pertaining to your case, so that should have been addressed or that were wrong in the beginning that the attorneys didn't catch. So do you want to share any of that? Or
yeah, I can share some of that. Well, you know, in the beginning, you know, I was 16, I was poorly educated, and I didn't have access to resources, so a lot of the words that the judge, the prosecutor, and my public defender were saying sounded like the adults on Charles Brown. Wah, 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 wah.
Right, because you didn't understand. Right.
So I had to go through a process of learning what was being said in the law. I had to sit down and rather than going out and playing basketball and doing everything else that everybody else was doing, I went to the law library, and I studied day after day, year after year, month after month. I just continued to pour through the law, and I asked questions all the time. Matter of fact, I would get on people's nerves because I'd ask so many questions.
Right.
And that's how I learned what happened and what went wrong and what I could possibly do to fight for my innocence and fight for my life.
Right, right. And you know, some people may not know that eyewitness testimony, it can be damaging if it's the wrong testimony. You know, because in criminal law, eyewitness testimony is considered evidence.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's one of the strongest pieces of evidence, but in actuality, it's really one of the weakest, because memory is not as strong as a lot of people had thought back in the day. For example, you know, in my case, the eyewitness initially told was also the victim. The sole eyewitness is also the victim. He had called 911 and told the 911 operator that he was unable to identify any distinguishing facial features or describe what the assailant was wearing. But then in the hospital, you know, the police kept going and talked to him, you know, knowing beforehand this 911 tape, and continued to ask him information about what happened at the crime scene. And they prepared police reports, and then they gave him the police reports. But prior to that, the guy was in the hospital, and they presented a photo lineup.
So wait a minute. Let me stop you real quick so our viewers can get a good understanding. So you're saying that the police officers gave the witness in your case reports and coached him per the reports
of what
to say?
It's evident from the record. I mean, he actually admitted to this in the deposition.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's in black and white. Man, if it's on my website, they can go log on there and find it. It's actually on there.
Okay, what is your website? Give your website real quick. What is your website?
www.freejonathanirons.com.
Okay, and on there, people can go. If you guys may not have heard him, it's www.freejonathanirons.com, you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and you guys can go there, and he says that these things are actually on his website, different points. And I know that I was on there last night. You have a very, very nice website. Hats off to your advocacy team. They are doing a wonderful, wonderful job. I've had a chance to speak with a couple of them, and they just seem to be just very, very nice people. A true and real blessing to you. Amen.
Yes, ma'am.
And,
yes, ma'am.
You know, I commend them, because not everyone wants to take up this fight. Okay. Not everyone wants to take up this fight. It actually takes a special person, a call person, to be able to do it. But I want to go back to something else that people most definitely need to understand. And that is eyewitness misidentification. I know I gave the percentages about how 73% of the 239 DNA convictions that were overturned back in the early 90s came about as false eyewitness testimony. But I want to say this, that eyewitness misidentification is the greatest contributing factor, not a greatest, but the greatest contributing factor to wrongful convictions. This is proven by DNA testing. Wow.
Yeah. But think about this. Everybody doesn't have access to DNA, and you can't know what's going on in the minds of these eyewitnesses, or what's being said, or how they're being manipulated to identifying people.
Right.
But it's evident. It's evident from his history, and it's evident from the records of these cases, especially in mine, that, you know, you can't go from not identifying anybody to giving a detailed account of what somebody's wearing in a police report. It just doesn't work that way. The mind works when as time progresses, your memories begin to fade. It doesn't go on the opposite. Your mind doesn't get better with time; it gets worse.
Right. And that's absolutely correct. And then, of course, we know in some cases there are just situations where the eyewitnesses were pressured or forced or coerced to implement someone as the assailant in a crime. We've seen that a lot in cases over in Cook County in Chicago. We've seen it a lot in Harris County, Dallas County out of Texas. So we know that happens, and we know for sure it happens right here in Jackson County, Missouri, because that is most definitely information that I have, not just to Keith Carnes' case, but a few others as well. So let's go back really quick to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue really quick, because I want everyone to know to know this here, and I want you to come in with me and help me out and correct me if I'm off a little bit here, but everyone has a right. Right. I just want to make sure everyone has a right to effective to have counsel. Correct.
Sixth Amendment, yes, ma'am.
Right, it's part of the amendment. And which amendment, Mr. Irons, is that part of?
The Sixth Amendment. The Fourteenth Amendment, because it's due process. Everybody has a right to that.
The Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution is the section of the Bill of Rights that guarantees a citizen a speedy trial, a fair jury, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And there's some more to that as well. It also, they have to have an attorney, okay, if the accused wants one, okay? And yes. So the Sixth Amendment, I have seen, has been violated over and over and over again in several criminal cases that I've had the opportunity to review. And a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people don't know what their rights are. And if you don't know what your rights are, then when they're violated, you never know it, because you never know what the rights are from the beginning. So it's very important that we know our rights. You know, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the importance of having effective assistance of counsel is like going into a fight with both hands. If you have an attorney with one or two hands behind the back while the opponent, your prosecutor, has both hands flying free, you most definitely know what's going to be the end result of that.
Right, right. Because the Sixth Amendment actually contains five principles that affect the rights of a defendant in a criminal prosecution. It has the right to a speedy and public trial, the right to be tried, the right to be tried by an impartial jury, the right to be informed of the charges, the right to confront and call witnesses, and the right to an interview. Now, I've seen over and over again where we've had attorneys in cases that don't call forth witnesses. You know,
yeah, it happened in my case. I had an alibi witness. Matter of fact, two of them that were never called, but the prosecutor put them down on their witness list, but they never called them. We were, I guess, under the impression that they were going to call them, but nevertheless, my attorney never even went out to go and talk to them or interview them. Had they talked to them, they would have been able to provide testimony in front of the jury, which would have displayed that it was impossible for me to be even at the crime scene. I was two blocks away.
Right, right. I saw that when I read, you know, you've shared that with me. And I, you know, if you were two blocks away, how could you be over here committing this crime and you had a legitimate alibi? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen in cases where sometimes they won't take the statement of a family member, you know, saying that my loved one was here with me at home or my loved one was over here, you know. But when you can backtrack a person's alibi in your KCPD or whatever, St. Louis Department Police records, when you can backtrack an alibi and you have a paper trail to prove it, it makes you say, why did they not consider this? It's right here in black and white. You know, we have that. I mean, I believe in Ricky Kidd's case, Mr. Kidd was at an office applying for a gun permit, I believe, at the same time that they said he was over here committing the crime. You know, that's absolutely crazy. And then not only with Mr. Kidd's case, you know, you have in Mr. Carnes' case, well, one of the eyewitnesses that they used to, with a key eyewitness in his case, actually placed another individual at the crime scene with the weapon with Keith Carnes as he was supposed to be committing this crime. But this individual was actually at a bank the next state over on video bank surveillance tape that the Kansas City Police Department detectives verified that he was most definitely there, but they ignored that. And of course, it didn't come out until we got the paperwork and investigated and all these things came forward. Now, I want to say this, and that happens on a regular basis. I mean, I've seen it over and over again. But let me ask you this. I want to bring this up too. One thing I noticed, and I want you to clarify this for me, okay? One thing that I noticed when I looked at your website and I saw the picture, the lineup of you and the other guys there.
Yeah.
Your picture was bigger than everybody else's. And I didn't even know who you were, but just going to your website for the first time and seeing that, it drew me directly to the bigger picture. And it turned out that bigger picture was you. So is that the actual lineup that they used against you, dude?
Yes, ma'am. And we had conducted the test and found that my picture was blown up by 25% larger. The pixel count was larger than the rest of them. So that doesn't mean that I was physically bigger. It means that they intentionally blew my photo up. That's intent. And the kicker is this: the police literally asked this guy to give his best guess after he said he couldn't identify the person who shot him. And he picked two people. He picked me and number six. I was number three, and the other guy was number six. He looked totally different. And then he gave him that report to take home and that photograph, and he was allowed to study that and continue to go over that. And then even beyond that, the guy initially told one police officer that the assailant had a hooded sweatshirt on, and it was tied tightly around his face. However, the eyewitness, when he came to trial, he said the hood was down around his face. How do you get from seeing a hood up tied tightly around a person's face, which would prevent any view, to saying that the hood's down?
Right.
That's a red flag right there.
Right, right. Well, let me say this for those that are listening this morning. I'm your host, Latara Smith, and I'm interviewing Mr. Jonathan Irons. Mr. Irons is an individual that is innocent, wrongly convicted, being held within the Missouri Department of Corrections. I'm interviewing him this morning, and we are speaking on his case just a little bit here and there. But mainly, we're here discussing the issues of ineffective assistance of counsel, eyewitness identification issues, and how these two factors play into wrongful convictions, because they do. And these are most, I have seen these errors over and over and over again. And it's just sad. And what's really sad is that, you know, we have attorneys that, you know, represent clients, and an attorney is supposed to diligently advocate for their client. They're supposed to do everything they can to defend their client, but yet I've seen it over and over again not happen. And I'm not saying that all attorneys don't diligently represent, because I have some very good friends that are attorneys. I have some sorority sisters that are attorneys, and I know good attorneys that are just good attorneys that I'm not connected to. So I'm not saying all attorneys are bad.
I have some now.
You have some now.
I know some public defenders that are really good. Not all public defenders are bad. They're just overworked and don't have access to the resources or the same amount of resources as prosecutors do.
Right, right. Now, let me ask you a question. We have a new director of the public defender's office. Do you think that this will change or make a difference?
I think what would help them make a difference, if they have a larger budget, you know, and access to a larger staff, because the problem isn't the directors, it's the resources. They don't have access to resources and manpower. Public defenders are overworked, underpaid, and don't have access to the resources that prosecutors have.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, how is it? How can they go up against the prosecutor's office when they have exponential, unlimited access to experts, the power of the police department? They have a standing army of investigators in the police department. Public defenders don't. They don't.
Right. Well, I can tell you this, Mr. Irons, we're getting pretty closer to the end of the show, but before we go, I want to ask you, what is it that you are hoping to happen with your case? Where are you at right now? Not going into real detail, but kind of where are you at right now, and what is it that you're hoping to do with your case?
I'm hoping at the very least I get a new trial.
Amen.
I get a new trial, man. I'm going to be able to prove that I didn't do this, because I have a team now that is for me, have access to resources. People have gotten behind my case, and they support it, and the truth is going to come out. You know, it's been silent for all these years, but the truth is going to come out, and they're going to hear it. People are going to hear it, and when people hear it, it really frustrates them. Not just with the bits and pieces with people, with the prosecutor and what the state has put out over the years and on the federal case level. You know, it's going to come out. Right now, you know, we're working on continuing to investigate my case, digging for details, and in the same process, where my legal team is taking steps to put together a petition for my release.
Okay.
You know, and that's what we're going for right now, and at the very least, to get me a new trial.
Amen. Well, you know, of course, you know the Casey Freedom Project is 100% behind you. Whatever we can do to be a blessing and assist your advocacy team, we are in like Flynn, because I believe in your innocence. Amen. And,
amen. Thank you.
You know, once again, hats off to your advocacy team. You have an awesome page. And I want to encourage other people that are listening who have a loved one that is innocent, wrongly convicted. I want to encourage you guys to advocate for your loved one, it is so important that you advocate and that you be a voice for them, because their voices cannot be heard from behind those prison walls. They cannot be heard, so they need you. They need you to advocate for them and bring attention and awareness to their wrongful conviction. Now, Jonathan, real quick, we've got about a minute left. Is there anything else that you wanted to say before we head out?
Absolutely. I want to say thank you to all those people who are listening. I'd like to thank you and the staff members of the Jaws of Justice for giving me an opportunity to speak about my case and giving me a platform, because
Amen.
I haven't been able to speak or have my voice heard in over 20 years.
Right.
It's just been silent. I also want to say Happy Mother's Day to all the wonderful mothers out there in the world. I have been blessed with the love of more than one mother.
Amen.
And they have taken care of me and nurtured me. And mothers are a beautiful thing. We got to celebrate them, y'all.
Right. So we Push send a up. Shout out to all mothers, but we want to spend a special shout out to the mothers who have sons and daughters that are innocently wrongly convicted in prison. Mr. Irons, it was a blessing having you. We've got to go. Thank you so much for calling in. And we'll be praying for you and believing for your vindication, exoneration, and release. Amen.
Happy Mother's Day to you, too.
Thank you. Thank you as well. Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
All right, bye-bye.
Awesome. Well, everyone, that was Mr. Jonathan Irons. We were coming close to our end of our show, and I believe the second part of the show we're going to be accepting call-ins. We also have another guest, which is part of Mr. Irons' advocacy team. Is Mr. Williams on the line by chance?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, hello, Mr. Williams. Thank you. Thank you for contacting us and calling in today. It's a blessing to have you here as well. Jonathan's already gone off the line, and we had a wonderful interview with him, and he told us bits and pieces about his case. So real quick before we get going, this part of our show is a call-in show, so we most definitely want to welcome those of you who want to call in with questions. The number, if you want to call in, is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. Now, Mr. Williams. Okay. And right now, I tell you what, we're going to take a break, actually, before we go into taking calls on the show. Okay, just 1 second.
Now, the calendar for May 8th. The Cross Border Network hosts an evening of spoken word and song with Melissa Cardoza and Carla Lara on a tour of the U.S. honoring the life of Berta Caceres, a Honduran activist killed for her activism. This bilingual evening of poetry and song will be Wednesday, May 10th, 7 to 9 p.m., at the Uptown Arts Bar, 3611 Broadway, KCMO. Email at info@crossbordernetwork.org for information and suggested donation. Change Yourself, Change Your World, Moore Square's annual Transformation Banquet will be held Thursday, June 8th at the Marriott Muehlbach, 1201 Wyandotte Street, KCMO. Social hour starts at 5:30 p.m. with dinner at 6:30 p.m. Speakers will include Reverend B. Denise Welch, National Chair of Gamaliel Women Leadership Training, and Reverend Dr. John Welch, Chair of the Gamaliel Board of Directors. For information on tickets and price, contact Doug Schaefer at 816-210-8822. Or by email at trustbuster@yahoo.com. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, May 13th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD have members that may be able to help. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, for sitting in for Beth Pike.
Awesome. Well, hi, this is Latar Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. And this morning, the second part of our show, I'm going to be interviewing Mr. Reggie Williams. The first part of our show, just to kind of catch everyone up who may just now be tuning in, I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Irons, who was, Mr. Irons is currently incarcerated within the Missouri Department of Corrections. He is innocent and wrongly convicted. And unfortunately, he's been incarcerated since the age of 16. He's been there now for approximately 20 years for a crime that he did not commit. And so we were able to hear from him a little bit about his case. And now on the phone, I have Mr. Reggie Williams, which is actually part of Mr. Irons' advocacy team. And I just want to hear from, we want to hear from you, Mr. Williams, and, you know, get your ideals and just kind of your insight on what you've seen happen in the investigations that you've been doing, because from what I understand, you've literally just jumped in, took over the investigative part of the case, and you've been able to uncover lots of information. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, that's correct. You know, the biggest thing is how we came into Jonathan's life. We're not related to him.
Right.
We came in through my father-in-law, who was a BIC at the prison, and asked us to just reach out to him and just send him email. I mean, not emails, but letters to encourage him. So in that process, he gave me access to his files, and I was able to get all his documents from the public defender's office. And then, you know, and I'm a Christian person, and I think the Lord just kind of helped me navigate through that, because, you know, I don't have a law background, even though I'm educated.
Right.
So there's a lot of terms and things that I had to, you know, I had to understand as I went through there. But, you know, as I went through that box, and it was several boxes, actually.
Right, right.
I uncovered a lot of things that were red flags to me. And I looked at it as, I know you talk about being an advocate, but, you know, as citizens, it's very important that we understand the law and that we understand how the law process works. And, you know, I've got three boys, so I've kind of got a vested interest in wanting to know, because I don't want any of my children to get caught up in the system the way Jonathan did at 16.
Right.
So I looked through it if I was on as a juror, and the things that I saw in his case just alarmed me so much that, you know, my wife and I dedicated that we would support him and help him until we can get him free from the Missouri State Penitentiary.
Now, let me ask you something. You said your father-in-law was a VIC. Can you explain for our listeners what a VIC is?
Well, VIC is, you know, they're a volunteer, and what he did is he volunteered at the church choir. He's a musician, and so he met Jonathan in the choir because he was conducting the choir, and then he happened to meet him. But he meets a lot of inmates in there. But Jonathan kind of stood out to him, and he had lost his grandmother, and he had asked us to reach out at that point, you know, at a time where he kind of really needed somebody to connect with him. So
I see. And when you say that you got his files, you didn't get them from your father-in-law. I want to make sure that everyone understands that. You got Jonathan gave you access to his files through the public defender's office, correct?
Right.
Okay. Okay. I just want to make sure we made that point.
He wrote up a pro se power of attorney document. He's very versed in the law, and so he sent that to me, and I took the power of attorney, and then I was able to get all the original files from the public defender's office.
So. Okay. Well, everyone, I want to invite anyone to call in that may have questions. Your questions are most definitely welcome. The call-in number here is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. Now, Mr. Williams, you said you saw some things that were very alarming when you began to take Mr. Irons' case and break it down. Can you go over a few of those alarming details, please?
You know, one of the biggest things was the identification. And so there's a photo lineup in there, and there's six pictures on a page.
Right.
And it was very interesting to see that, you know, when you look at the photo lineup.
Okay. I believe we've lost Mr. Williams. Maybe he's going to try to call back in here in just a few you know, we're sorry about that, everyone. But what he was talking about, which we already kind of addressed at the beginning of the interview, is in the lineup in Mr. Irons' case, actually, Mr. Irons' face was much larger than everyone else. And when I went to the website, I noticed that right off the bat. I mean, it just drew my attention straight to his face. And I was like, wow, you know, and then it turned out that that was him. So that most definitely is raising some issues, I would think, when it comes to eyewitness identification and the process by which they do that. Now, I know over in Baltimore, they have started what's called a double blind sequential photo identification process, meaning that the individual who's conducting it's called a double blinded lineup. And what that is that neither the person showing the lineup nor the witness knows which picture is the real suspect. So that most definitely is something I think that all police departments should take up and do, because it makes, you know, it doesn't create a situation where someone can point out, you know, who the individual is. I believe that's one of the claims in Keith Carnes' case, with one of the eyewitnesses saying that the prosecutor told her, no, this is who you say did it. As opposed to when she pointed out the real assailant for what Mr. Carnes is incarcerated for, the crime, the prosecutor, according to the witness's affidavit and video, you know, simply stated that the former prosecutor said, no, this is who you say did it. OK, so we know that there's been some flaws with our witness identification issues, and that we like we said earlier, our witness identification issues are some of the main problems. One of the leading problems that leads to wrongful convictions. So do we have Mr. Williams back on the line by chance? OK, awesome. Mr. Williams.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm sorry.
Somehow we got disconnected.
Yeah, so. That's okay. I just kind of went on with the interview until you came on. But I picked up where you left off and was explaining to the listeners how when I went to Jonathan's page and I was going down his website, I was able to see that eyewitness identification picture that they use in lineup. And his picture was it was larger, and it automatically drew my attention. So I can imagine if I was a victim, and I'm here, you know, and I'm looking at this, if it drew my attention immediately, and I don't have anything to do with the case, didn't know anything about it, I'm looking at it over the internet, I can only imagine how the victim, it would draw his attention as well. Do you agree?
Oh, definitely. And you know, just the simple fact that they told him to guess. You shouldn't have to guess when you're going to put somebody away for a long time. I think if there wasn't any certainty, then they should have, you know, taken a different measure to have him identify, you know, even an actual lineup. So they never did an actual lineup. They only used that photo lineup, and that's how Jonathan was identified.
Now, there was no other evidence that caused Mr. Irons to be wrongly convicted but the testimony of the eyewitness, correct?
I would say yes.
Okay.
You know, he was in the neighborhood that day. So people tried to, you know, but anybody could be in the neighborhood. I mean, he was in the neighborhood before. He had friends in the neighborhood. Matter of fact, where he was seen two blocks away was around the same time that this person said that they came home and entered their house. So you can't be two places at the same time. And one of the things that I was, you know, I didn't understand is why his public defender didn't put an alibi case going forward, but she chose not to. So
right. Well, I want to tell you too, I want to announce Mr. Irons' website here so that people can go and actually see what we're talking about. Okay. I believe it's www.jonathanirons.com. is that correct, Mr. Williams?
Yes.
Okay. And so, everyone, I strongly encourage you to go and look and see exactly. I see they're pulling it up here in the office now. Go and look and see exactly what we're talking about. And you are going to be in absolute awe when you see what they did here. Now, I've talked about what they did, but I have not asked the question, what police department is responsible for this travesty here?
Well, it's a police department in the St. Louis area, and the O'Fallon Police Department. That was the arresting police department in this case. I want to make a correction. I think it might be www.freejonathanirons.com.
Okay, www.freejonathanirons.com. Okay,
yeah,
awesome.
Just in case that didn't work, because I don't have the information in front of me. So.
Okay. And I actually it is, because we just pulled it up here in the room here. So it most definitely is, everyone. So once again, I think we gave out the incorrect website for Mr. Irons. So let's correct that now. www.freejonathanirons.com. Amen. Okay. So what other things did you see in the case that just raised your eyebrows and said, wait a minute, something here is not right?
Yeah, so, you know, that was a big one to me, is how he was identified. The other thing was that there wasn't an alibi put forward, especially the guy was very specific about the time that he got home. And because of the time he got home, the person had to already be in the house for him to have that encounter that he had. It couldn't be that the person came into the house after he was already home. So that was very problematic to me when I was looking at the facts. There were a lot of other things. You know, there was no physical evidence tying him to that scene whatsoever, even though there was fingerprints found at the scene. They did not match him. So to me, when you have something that doesn't match a person, that eliminates them as the suspect. But they still kept going forward with this theory that he was the person. You know, also, he had had a burglary 3 weeks before, and they were, and people had broken into his house and stole some watches, and there was a small amount of money that was taken, and there were fingerprints in that one. And it amazes me that I've never seen where they compared the fingerprints from the prior to the recent. So you didn't get any of that evidence, and that, you know, that's another thing that, you know, stood out to me as a huge red flag.
Right, so. And you know, I know that you took up Jonathan's cause, and I just want to commend you and Mrs. Williams for doing so, for having a heart and wanting to help someone. You don't see that very often in this day and time. So I most definitely want to thank you. You know, from the bottom of my heart for helping Jonathan, because, you know, we all know that advocating for those who are innocent, wrongly convicted is most definitely what I do. That's my calling. And so to see someone else doing that, it just delights my heart. So once again, I want to thank you.
Yeah, I think it's really important what you're doing and what your station's doing is just bringing an awareness, because I can tell you as a citizen, I didn't know how bad things could get, or how, you know, just the normal public needs to be aware of, you know, because we put a lot of trust in the Justice Department. We put a lot of trust that they are doing the right things. Now, granted, they're human beings, and you know, all of us human beings have flaws, but to me, somebody has to check the checker. So
yes,
when they put things in place like immunity for prosecutors and they insulate themselves from being checked, and I think that's a danger to the public, because they're supposed to be protecting us, but yet I don't think they always follow their own rules.
Right. Well, we know they don't always do that. But, you know, I want to invite anyone that may have dealt with this type of situation to call in and encourage you to ask questions, because we want to hear from you. We most definitely want to hear from you, because we know that this happens on a regular basis. Once again, our studio, the number here in the studio is 816-931-5534. Now, Mr. Williams, I can tell you, too, that lately we have seen where there are a lot of individuals like yourself or like myself that have begun to take up these type of causes, not necessarily locally, but I mean, just throughout the various states. You know, we've seen that Ryan Ferguson, you know, he put together his show. He was blessed to be able to do that, where he, you know, went along with another young lady and they began to, you know, do their own investigations. Not that he's a private investigator and not that you're a private investigator, but just to take up the cause, because it doesn't necessarily take a private investigator or a lawyer to come up with things that, you know, that are found in these cases. And so I believe that more people are starting to you know, starting to take this cause up. And it's making a difference. It's making a difference. I know that I really don't believe that Michael Calvin Smith would be probably free today if he didn't have that attention and Ryan Ferguson them looking into his case. Are you familiar with who he is, Mr. Williams?
Yeah, I'm actually friends with Ryan's dad. So, you know, in the journey that, you know, Ryan's dad had, we met because they were both, you know, Jonathan and him were both at the same facility. So I know Ryan's mom and I know Ryan's dad. And you're right. You know, had Ryan's dad not done all that he did, that, you know, Ryan could still be in there. Because a lot of it is the public doesn't know. I mean, we just don't know. We go on with our daily lives and we're trying to pay our bills and take care of our families. We don't know what actually happens, you know, until the news gives you what they want you to hear. You know, Ryan's case exposed the whole lot, you know, especially when you're interviewing somebody, that somebody can have a dream and then put you in prison for 40 years with no other evidence. That was just crazy. And so that's why I think the public needs to be aware. And, you know, what you're talking about is have some advocacy, because it affects all of us. It could be anybody's child. It could be anybody's husband. It could be anybody. And until you make sure that they're being held accountable for what we vote them in to do, then, you know, that becomes very problematic to us as citizens.
Right. I totally agree. I totally agree with that. And, you know, I think it's sad, too, that we have situations that are even led to these wrongful convictions of, you know, attorneys not doing what they should do, or even to say an overzealous prosecutor prosecuting cases that they know is not a legitimate case, pursuing charges and I mean, I've seen everything. I've seen statement of probable cause statements that were tainted, that were defective, where the detectives just outright lied in them. I've seen that happen. And I mean, it's so much that goes on to lead to these wrongful convictions. And it takes people to actually sit down and dig through and find these inconsistencies. Because trust me, if there's someone that has a post-conviction claim of actual innocence, you can best believe when you pull their files, if you pull the police investigative file, or you pull the prosecutor's file, when you pull the court records, you are going to find not just a lot of inconsistencies, but some outright lies, because that's exactly what happened in Keith Karn's case, from forging of documents. I mean, you name it, it was done. And I think this is really, really, really sad. So when it comes to Mr. Irons' case, what is your plan now as his advocate? What is your plan now moving forward? And what is it that you want to see in this situation?
Well, he has an attorney right now, and we're working through that attorney to bring some of the things that we found into the light. And so I think, you know, because everything does have to be done through the court system. So it's just getting those and then shoring up some things to make sure that, you know, and this is another thing I just want to throw out real quickly. You know, they have a lot of rules, like there's a harmless error rule, and I think people need to understand that that exists.
Right. Good point.
A lot of us would say, well, you know, well, I did this, that was harmless, and we would still get in trouble, get a ticket or whatever, you know. But yet they can have harmless, what they call, oh, that was a harmless error. But I think some of those errors are not harmless. They're on purpose, and because it's part of their strategy, and I think they need to be looked at and not allowed to just be whisked away by the court that it's only harmless. So it's little things like that that kind of add up. If you see multiple harmless errors, there's more than a harmless error going on. So,
Right. Now, with Mr. Irons' case, because I most definitely want to take this time to bring about awareness to his case, do you guys have any future events planned for Mr. Irons that, you know, I know that you guys gave a really nice event. How long ago did you guys give that event? I saw it on the website. I believe you guys had it at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah, it was probably just about a month ago. But yeah, there will be more awareness events in the future as we move forward and as things progress. And we'll be updating, and, you know, we have a connection with you. We'll make sure you're updated so you can let your listeners know. But, yeah, the biggest thing that I would like is prayer, of course, because I'm a praying man.
Amen.
And just awareness. Just the public needs to be aware, because as we vote these judges and we vote these prosecutors,
yes,
in, we need to know their background. We need to know, you know,
who they're connected.
And I think, really, I think politics needs to be taken out of being a prosecutor personally. So, the public defender doesn't have, they're appointed, but yet prosecutors are elected. So,
well, yeah, unless you live in Jackson County like me, where no one runs against your local prosecutor, so she's back in office again, and preferably someone will run against Mrs. Baker, because we most definitely need a change in the prosecutor's office, starting with the head of the prosecutor's office. I just had to take the opportunity to say that. And the reason I say that is because, you know, our local prosecutor has had the opportunity to right some wrongs in several cases, and she opted not to do that. So that makes me kind of look at her and you know, say, wow, really, what's going on with you? You know, why would you not want to do, because she has an ethical duty to uphold the law. She has an ethical duty to address these issues. You know, whenever there is clear and convincing evidence that someone is innocent of a crime, our prosecutor is supposed to address it, not ignore it and then put it off on the attorney general's office. No, you should address that locally within your jurisdiction, because that's what you're supposed to do. And you're supposed to hold your prosecutors accountable, you know, or your police officers. I know in Keith Carnes' case, we had witnesses that the police officers actually picked up, transported in, took their witness statements, and the entire time, two of these witnesses that they took statements from had capious felony warrants for their arrest, and these police failed to arrest them by executing those arrest warrants. So now we can let police officers commit Class D felonies and not hold neither of them accountable for that. You know, and that's what happened here. And when we have a prosecutor that won't go forth and bring forth charges against these individuals because they are police officers, okay, then yes, Jean Peters Baker, that is telling us that our police officers with the KCPD is most definitely above the law. Most definitely so. Now, Mr. Williams, we're kind of getting close to where we need to start closing down and everything. So is there anything else that you want to say, anything that you want to make our listeners aware of pertaining to Mr. Arnn's case? Where are things right now? I know that you guys have been blessed to get another attorney on the case. Where are we going now with Mr. Arnn's case?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is just shoring up the evidence that we already have and then putting it in a place to get it in front of the judge so we can move forward with getting him free. I think we have a very strong evidence that would free Jonathan. But as you know, you got to have your I's dotted and your T's crossed when you go back to court and you try to get a person out. I still think you made two points that I think the listeners definitely need to know. You need to hold your prosecutors accountable.
Yes.
And they need to be accountable. And also the police, because they hold us accountable if we break the law. So it's a two-way thing. So,
yes.
Yeah, they're voted in, the prosecutors. Well, you can hold them accountable with your vote. You can hold them accountable at town halls when you have the opportunity to be in front of them and ask them questions of how they think and how they do things, because I really truly believe you take politics out of it and they are held accountable like any employee that's held accountable at their job, then things would be a lot different.
Right. And, you know, you see that going on over in Texas. Actually, there was a prosecutor that was actually they brought charges up against him and foul charges against him, felony charges, you know, in a case. So, you know, we do know over in Texas, some parts, they are holding prosecutors and people accountable. So, Mr. Williams, it's time for us to end the show, but I want to thank you so much for calling in. And hats off to the work that you're doing for Mr. Irons. And once again, the Casey Freedom Project is here to support you. And thank you for calling in,
sir. Okay. We'll keep you guys updated.
Amen. Thank you. Have a blessed day. All right. So, everyone, we just thank you guys for tuning in to the show today. I hope that you have some information that served as a blessing and that will help you moving forward in any cases that you may be fighting for your loved ones. Have a good day.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
I'm Patricia Sully. I'm a staff attorney with the Public Defender Association, and I coordinate Vocal Washington, which is a grassroots organizing effort. We organize folks who are low and no income and directly affected by the war on drugs, mass incarceration, homelessness, and the HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C epidemics. We're currently focused on the campaign for supervised consumption spaces, which are spaces where people who use drugs, whether that's injection or inhalation, can come inside and use those drugs under medical supervision without fear of arrest and where there's connection to other services. So right now, out on the street, there are many people who use drugs, and we see a lot of overdose and a lot of public health harm that comes with that outdoor drug use, whether those are abscesses and infections or endocarditis, other public health issues that develop. And that's all preventable, or much of that is preventable. And right now, people really have no place to go, and particularly folks who are unhoused. Many of the people we work with do not have housing. And so if those are people who are living with substance use disorder, their drug use by necessity happens outside. And in Seattle, we have a really innovative program called LEAD, which is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And LEAD is a harm reduction-based program. So LEAD works with people who use drugs outside. And when an officer, a police officer, encounters someone outside using drugs, that officer can, instead of arresting and booking that person in jail, immediately divert them to wraparound case management services. And this program has worked really well. We've had it studied and evaluated, and it's produced really good outcomes. But even with LEAD, but there's really no place to tell that person to go, right? The best answer anybody has is go to a different alley. Go use your drugs somewhere else. And we all know that that's not a satisfactory answer. It's not satisfactory for the person who's using drugs, because that person is still at risk of overdose and at risk of these public health harms. And it's not a satisfactory answer for the community who's really struggling with outdoor drug use and drug use happening in, you know, bathrooms of the library or their businesses or in front of the streets. So supervised consumption spaces really arose in part as an answer to that question. What do we tell people? Where should people go?
Thank you, Patricia. I was going to ask you how I might influence my local politicians or politicians anywhere. I think all I got to do is just share your words. I thank you so very much. Is there a website or a closing thought you might want to relay?
Yeah, so people can find more information at vocal-wa.org or defender.org.
I met Patricia last week at the Drug Policy Alliance gathering. I found friends and allies who are going to help me set up a needle exchange program here in Houston, Harris County. If you would like to be involved, please contact me, dean@drugtruth.net. This is Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.